In association with Newsarama, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. On this edition, it's time for part two of the Brubaker testimony. We pick up where we left off with writer Ed Brubaker. You'll hear more about the characters of Steve Rogers and Bucky Barnes as they share the mantle of Captain America in the Captain America Reborn miniseries. And we find out what Ed has planned in the months ahead in both the regular Captain America series and the Cap one-shot that's coming up in December. We look at Ed's wrap-up of Daredevil and where he's left the character for Andy Diggle to take over. Plus, we'll discuss some of the important supporting characters of Daredevils, including Dakota North, Lady Bullseye, and Master Izzo. And Ed gives his thoughts on the debate of, is Daredevil too dark, or is there room for a swashbuckling Daredevil these days? Plus, more talk about Criminal, Ed's internet crime film, Angel of Death, and some of his new TV and film recommendations as well. Now, if you missed part one, it is available on the RSS feed, or if you go to wordballoon.com, it's right there. The Brubaker Testimony, part one. This is part two. And we pick up right where we left off in conversation about Captain America Reborn. We discussed where the plot stood in part one. And now we get into a bit of character talk as we continue the Brubaker testimony, part two.
You mentioned colors, and I'm glad you mentioned Dave Stewart. I neglected to mention Paul Mounds on Reborn.
Oh, yeah. He's doing fantastic stuff there.
Yeah. I mean, that, and again, not a normal Captain America colorist, but again, for this event, I think very appropriate and interesting shades in this.
Well, Brian, you know, picks his own people for everything, so, you know, he just came with Brian, and it's, you know, when I got the first few pages of the first issue from, you know, like, emailed in, I was just like, oh my God, like, this is amazing looking. And I should take a moment to point out, I've noticed some people seem to be confused because of the way the credits are on the book. Like, they seem to think that Butch and Brian are alternating scenes or something, or that Butch is drawing some scenes and Brian's drawing others. But Brian is penciling the book and Butch is inking it.
Okay.
And, you know, and I'm writing it. I'm not drawing either. It just says by, you know, Ed Brubaker, Brian Hitch, and Butch Geis, you know. But I think I saw some people, you know, thinking that Butch was drawing the modern stuff and Brian was drawing the flashbacks or something. And it's like, no, Brian's drawing the whole book. And he's just, you know, Butch is inking him, and, you know, the big difference between Hitch working with most inkers, I think, and Hitch working with Butch is that, you know, Brian, I think one of the reasons that he's got a rep for, you know, being late on stuff might be that he's a total perfectionist, and he will inker proof pages to the point where, you know, they could pretty much print from his pencils, you know.
Okay.
And, you know, working with Butch, he can just pencil. He doesn't have to, like, go super crazy and make sure that there's nothing that the inker will misinterpret, because Butch can draw.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and, you know, but Brian is drawing it all, and it's, you know, and it's pretty amazing collaboration. I mean, I'm turning in scripts for 22-page issues, and he's drawing 30, 32 pages. You know,
that's
so
great.
Like, he'll call me up or email me, and he's like, I want to expand this scene, or I want to do this, and, you know, what do you think of this? And it's always like, oh, my God. So now I'm like, oh, no wonder, like, you know, the last couple issues of the Ultimates were 75 pages of material. You know, it's like, my God, this guy always has, like, a way to, you know, to take your scene and make it better, you know, or to take your, you know, and it changes the way I write, actually, when I'm working for him. I actually am trying to make sure, like, okay, well, is there anything visually interesting I can do with this scene that will make Brian then think of something else that will make it even more visually interesting?
That's
so it's
great.
Really, it's like almost instead of giving him something to draw, like hoping that I come across that one idea that sparks him to, like, then add a bunch of other crazy shit.
Very cool. And, you know, you're right. I think Butch and Brian together are kind of like Simon and Kirby, or when Klaus and Bill Sienkiewicz do something together, Klaus Janson. I mean, you really are getting two guys that really could do the job themselves if need be, but you get this great amalgam of styles that makes its own kind of product, and I think that's really,
I think, fun to see. You know, well, it's interesting. I don't know how much it's coming through in print or not, but, like, when Butch sends the inked pages in, it's like, it reminds me more than anything of, like, when Brian was doing The Authority, you know.
Interesting.
And, like, you can really see, especially on some pages, like the ones where there's just crazy detail. Like, Brian will send in these double-page spreads with just crazy amount of detail, and then seeing Butch ink them. And it almost, in some ways, reminds me of, like, Dick Giordano inking Neil Adams or
sure.
something. Like, there's a, I forget sometimes that there's a little bit of Neil Adams in Brian's stuff here and there. You know, and it's just, it's really great, though. Like, nobody draws a scene like Brian Hitch. Like, you know, nobody picks the same angles that he picks to, like, set the action up. And you know, he really does, you know, do that scene in issue two when Cap takes down Masterman.
Yes.
Like, I mean, in my script, that was a much shorter scene. And, you know, he just dove up and slammed into him, and they slammed into a wall. And Brian does this great thing where it's like, he pirouettes around and pushes off the wall and then crashes him into a car. And it's like, oh, my God. And you feel like you're there with them the whole time. Like, you know, it's just so much fun to see him do that stuff. Wait till issue three has a Prince Namor scene in it that's amazing.
Oh, very cool. That's great. You know, and again, man, it's good to have Steve back. It's so funny because, you know, in the back of our minds, we always knew he was eventually going to come back, but... or, you know, and granted, he hasn't fully come back yet. The story isn't over. But
yeah.
Just him being, you know, aware and conscious again and in the book, as opposed to the idealized icon that he was during Bucky's quest, you know, of taking the mantle. It's fun because now it really is like, wow, you got two really cool guys being Captain America. It's I hope there's room for both in this Marvel Universe because I'm enjoying seeing both of them.
Yeah, it's really going to be fun in the next few months when people see how the story shakes out.
Sure.
And, I'm working on this one shot for December that stars both of them, so it'll be interesting to see people reacting to the stuff that's going to happen. Because I hope that what we're going to do is not what, you know, at least not what everyone is expecting. But yeah, I'm really having a lot of fun with these characters. It's funny. I've been getting weird email from people where they're like, keep them both as Captain America. There were two Green Lanterns. Okay.
I have faith in you, and whatever the plan is, I'm going to enjoy the ride. But it's like, you know, and I hate this word, they've taken male bonding to this annoying pop culture thing and calling it bromance. And
isn't that weird how the word bromance is like a thing now?
Yeah, it's very icky.
It just when did the word get coined? Because it's like everywhere now. And
I know.
First time I heard it was like 6 months ago or something, and now I hear it almost daily.
And it's
someone's like, "Yeah, bromance this, bromance that," you know. And it's like Joe was doing some interview the other day where he mentioned that they were. Jokingly talking about releasing a best of Marvel team up and calling it the Marvel Bromance.
Oh, God.
And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, please no.
The thing meets the thing. It's a bromance.
But that's the thing. I mean, really, Steve and Bucky are like, you felt for both characters when Steve was trying to reach out to him as the Winter Soldier and get to the man inside of the the programming. And
they're like brothers, you know.
Sure.
And they fought in World War II for 5 years together. And, you know, it's a total band of brothers thing with those guys.
Yeah, and that's, you know,
Bucky's only a few years younger than Steve, so, you know, he's got the older brother that he always looked up to that he could never be as good as, you know, and that he would never really want to be as good as, because it's annoying that Steve always does the right thing when Bucky would, you know, often rather just punch someone.
But also that Steve now can face a world where his greatest regret has been erased. I mean, you know, that terrible,
true.
You know, defining thing that made him who he was since coming back in the Marvel Age, you know, is now negated. And it's, no, you didn't cause this guy to, you know, you don't have to carry that guilt around anymore. Your friend is alive
true.
Again. And I think that's kind
game,
of,
game
you know,
almost.
Yeah.
I might have to kill him again. I don't want to remove Steve's trauma of being the man out of time.
Well, he can, you know, there's other things for him to be bummed about. I won't deny that I really did. It was those very brief moments of the two of them working together again that I was like, oh,
yeah,
I missed that.
Yeah, it was cool. That moment when they took down the giant robot together.
Hell yes.
Yeah. No, I know exactly what you mean. That was like a big thing for me where I was like, oh, yeah, Cap and Bucky side by side. They're the real Cap and Bucky fighting.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a robot. It's not Jack Monroe. It's not.
Yeah, it's so much better than them fighting each other.
It's not Rick Jones, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, how many times was it a fucking robot? Like 3 times.
Yeah. Yeah, no, shit. After a while, dude. Very
I
funny.
Know, I recently reread those ones from the
Essentials.
I want to say Strange Tales, but no, it's
Tales of Suspense?
Tales of Suspense, yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, when they did like a 3-parter there with the robot, and then they did the one with that when Gene Colan was drawing it, they had a robot then too, yeah. And it's like, Jesus Christ, how many robots of Bucky is Cap gonna fall for?
What's that grinding sound when you're talking to me, Bucky? Nothing. I hate you.
Cap, please help me. There are Nazis here.
I gotta mention Daredevil, man, because you wrapped it up. And, and much like Brian left you in a very interesting position, I guess you're leaving poor Andy Dickel in a very interesting position.
Yeah, that was the reason that I left when I did, actually. Like, I had no plans originally to leave that book right then, and I had at least another year on that book sort of in my head, like, oh, I'll do this, and I'll do this. And
interesting.
But I knew with the Marvels project coming up and, you know, just, I could see in my schedule that something had to give, that I needed some time to have a few less projects to work on so that I could catch up on stuff, and you know, otherwise I was just going to have a nervous breakdown. And I really didn't want to quit Daredevil. I didn't want to quit working with Michael, and I really, you know, didn't want to quit working with Warren Simons. And it really just came down to issue 500, the end of, you know, the Return of the King storyline, was the best place to leave the book so that whoever had to follow me was in a really fucked spot. And it was, I couldn't think of, it would have been at least a year or two before I could have found another spot like that to leave Matt in that would have been a challenge for whoever followed me. And I really felt like I liked the idea of Daredevil from now on being the when the baton is passed, it is the Daredevil challenge. Like, okay, what are you going to do with this? You know, it's like,
absolutely.
I really hope that Andy, like, when Andy eventually quits the book, that he, like, on those last page has, like, Foggy shoot Matt in the face or something. You know, and it's like, oh my God, Matt Murdock's been killed and Foggy Nelson is the murderer. And that's like, here you go, Jason Aaron. You know, like I think that's how Daredevil should be from now on. It should be, you know, when you leave your run, like whoever's following you, it's like cliffhanger. You know, it's like,
yes,
that old DC comic that was so awful that where, you know, but it was such a great idea. We'll leave it at a cliffhanger, and it's like, and you know, and then the next page was always like, "Whoa, thank God I had a rope."
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, no, that's not a cliffhanger.
No, fair enough. Well, and that's,
yeah.
But that's what made your first arc so much fun when Brian handed you the book.
Yeah, watch Andy's first page. It's probably like 1 year later. Whew, thank God I dealt with all those ninjas. Boy, it's sure nice to be back in Hell's Kitchen working as a lawyer again. Hey, Karen Page.
Well, and you know, I just spoke with Paul Jenkins, and a few months ago I had a conversation with Loeb. And now stepping off of Daredevil, it's fair to ask you this question. You know, because I guess, you know, Loeb is just like, he misses the swashbuckling happy Daredevil stories of years past. And not that, and again, not in terms of shitting on what you and Brian have done and Kevin Smith and certainly Frank and all of these fine people that have told these very hardcore crime stories and made Daredevil the character that he is today. But when I talked to Paul Jenkins, I guess he had a conversation with Dan Buckland. He said, I would love to see just Daredevil have one good day. Can't Daredevil ever have
You'd
one
think it good... would be a dream.
But that's
I gave him a few good days. You just take them away immediately.
Well, okay, and that's fair.
I tried to do a swashbuckling storyline in the book, actually. My second storyline was a bit of a
The European. Yeah, the European
The
story.
European vacation story.
Absolutely.
Where he was swashbuckling around Europe, and, you know, he fought the Matador, and, you know, and that was as close to the swashbuckling stuff as I could get with what I was doing with the book. And I'll be honest with you, fans didn't like it that much.
I understand.
Fans, like, who complain that they want, I want the swashbuckling Daredevil back. The minute you give it to them, they're like, oh, Daredevil's gritty and dark. like, he, I don't know. It's like, I mean, those people are impossible to please anyway, but.
Certainly.
But yeah, it's just, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's just being too much of a, you know, kid brought up on Frank Miller comics to be able to completely escape that shadow. You know, maybe somebody has to come into Daredevil who's never read a Frank Miller Daredevil before. You know, I'd love to see Loeb, you know, do some, you know, swashbuckling Daredevil stories and have them actually be good. It's really hard to do that. You know, you go back and you read a lot of those sort of swashbuckly Daredevil stuff, and actually a lot of it was pretty dark, comparatively. I mean, he's a blind guy whose girlfriend keeps leaving him.
Yeah.
You know, and, and you know, he develops a split personality.
Mike Murdoch.
Yeah, and you know, who's like some weird beatnik, and that really doesn't make any sense at all.
No, but I'm always happy when Mike Murdoch does pop up in stories and stuff as a comic.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah, I used Mike Murdoch a little bit.
Yes.
I had him use Mike Murdoch's passport to leave the country.
That was awesome,
really,
yeah.
Really funny. Just a little bit of a nod to the Mike Murdoch era. You know, like, I needed to do something.
Well, and then the other knock on the swashbuckler thing is that I think before Frank, a lot of people would say, you know, at the end of the day, what makes Daredevil that much different from Spider-Man? If you do have
yeah,
him
exactly.
be a happy swinger.
He was a wisecracker, and he swung around. He swung around. Dick Swang. Like Dick Sprang's archenemy, Dick Swang.
Dick Swang? I assumed that was a move that he would pull on Karen when he'd just, like, show up and start Dick Swanging around. Hey, how you doing, baby?
Dude, I work for Disney. What are you talking about?
I'm sorry, exactly.
Well, I'm sorry, not until January. Right?
Well, I look forward to Andy Diggle working the Incredibles into the next Daredevil story, then.
Yeah, exactly.
Mr. Incredible, yeah. What are you doing in Hell's Kitchen?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I heard there's trouble here. We call it Clinton now.
So, but, you know, like you say, you have a year of stories that you were thinking about. So, you know, who's to say down the line there might be a need or an interest on your part to come back to Daredevil?
Well, it would have been the stuff that, you know, I mean, hopefully Andy will touch on some of the stuff. I sort of outlined for him some of the stuff I would have done and, you know, told him, like, well, this is why so-and-so is doing this, and this is why so-and-so is doing that. And so I gave him, you know, enough rope to hang himself with on the stuff. But, you know, I mean, I was still going to do the story where Matt took over the hand, and, you know, that was my ending of 500 was the same as I was going to end it, even if I was writing 501.
Okay.
So, you know, I didn't tell him, like, you know, and then the next year is this or this or this. I just said, you know, and he takes over the hand and take the book. You know, like, it's your book now, it's your problem, you know. But, you know, Andy had a lot of questions about, you know, character stuff and you know, well, you know, why was Mastroizzo doing this or why was, you know, so-and-so doing that? And, you know, so I answered a lot of questions for him. But, you know, I think some of it will tread over, you know, the stuff that I would have done with the book, just because, you know, he's running the hand. You know,
yeah.
Like, you got to do that story. So, and that was the story I was going to do. It was about, like, what happens when Matt runs the hand. So, but yeah, you know, I mean, who knows? At some point, you know, I was like, Brian's doing the Daredevil the End story,
right,
basically, and, you know, he's a great character. It's definitely, I wouldn't rule out ever doing more Daredevil again, but it's just, you know, I did the book for a long time, it feels like.
Okay. No,
I did,
and
like,
you
40
did
issues of it or something.
Yeah, no, you know, you had a good run. Absolutely.
Yeah.
The
I did more issues of Daredevil than I did of Catwoman.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. You know, and I loved Master Izzo, and I, you know, when you hear Lady Bullseye, you're like, really? And then you see Lady Bullseye, and you're like, oh, okay, never mind. This is good.
People really liked her, and that's
Absolutely.
Marco Jurkovic doing the costume design. You know, he's so fantastic.
Doesn't hurt.
But, yeah, that's people really ended up liking Lady Bullseye, and, you know, somebody at a comic convention was like, I wish Lady Bullseye's origin was better than, you know, it was, and I was like, what are you talking about? She's got a great origin. And he's like, yeah, she saw Bullseye once. And I'm like, no. She was being sold into white slavery, and she had gone insane and been, like, tortured by the Yakuza, and Bullseye inadvertently saved her life. That's not like Bullseye just happened to walk by. Like, you know, she had this sort of feverish, you know, moment of being inspired by him because she watched him kill, like, you know, 45 guys, you know, and inadvertently freed her. And, you know, like, but she was always, in my mind, a bit of a nod to Lady Snowblood. That was, you know, why it's Lady Bullseye.
Okay.
I just like that, you know, and Lady Snowblood, you know, is a famous Japanese comic and movie. And, you know, it's just, basically Lady Snowblood is kind of what Kill Bill is based on, too.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's very interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Kill Bill is a bit of a nod to the Lady Snowblood movies, where, you know, she's a lady samurai, basically, who, you know, she's gang raped and she goes back to kill everybody who's ever fucked with her, basically.
Interesting.
Yeah, they're classics.
And Master Izo.
One of Kelly Sue's favorite movies.
Oh, okay, there you go.
Yeah.
Oh, well, very good. And Master Izo, a great character and wonderful comic relief. And, you know, I kind of worried about him, and it was wonderful seeing his character develop and be an interesting, you know, interesting.
Yeah, I like that character a lot. I know that's the one thing about leaving books is that I was like, with leaving Iron Fist, like,
yes.
You know, it's like, I want to do more with, you know, the Prince of Orphans and, you know.
Yeah.
I love, you know, all the characters on those books, and, you know, it's like, you want to keep working on those characters. You want to be able to use them, you know, when you want to, and, you know, that's what's cool about Daredevil is you could bring in, you know, Danny Rand once in a while or something.
You bet.
Because they're in that same universe, sort of, and, you know, the same thing with leaving Daredevil. It's like, I really love, you know, it's funny how your favorite characters on books tend to end up being the supporting cast. You know, more than your main characters in some ways. Like, the character who only appears in, like, one scene every few issues somehow is more fun to write than the guy that you have to write every single page.
Sure.
And, you know, I think a lot of people's favorite character on Daredevil when they work on the book is Foggy. And, you know, for me, it was, like, you know, Dakota North.
I was going to say, it had to be. Okay,
yeah.
Cool, because, yeah, Dakota, man, what a sad, you know, another another Murdoch girlfriend left in the dust.
Yeah.
or conquest, I should say. Not really girlfriend, but just another sexual conquest. Yeah, all right, we're done.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I was really, in my mind, that Matt was really in love with her, actually. And,
okay.
And she was really in love with him, and they were just, it was just, you know, bad timing.
Not meant to be.
Which is why I was like, because how else could Matt Murdock fall in love than at the wrong time with the wrong person? You know, that's just his fucking luck, you know.
Sure.
Just his style, almost, is like, I'm in love, but you're married and your wife is in a mental institute. You know, so it just makes perfect sense. I mean, one thing that I really tried to do when I took over the book, too, was thematically, like, the first few arcs have to do with Matt's senses. And, like, the first arc has a lot about his sense of hearing, like being in prison and how loud prison is, and everything about that one is about his hearing, really, in a lot of ways. And in the second arc, the European one, was all about his sense of smell, even, you know, going back and sort of talking about the early days after his dad died and how his sense of smell reacted to all of that. Like, that was, to me, stuff that I hadn't actually seen anybody really talk about that much. Like, I love the way Michael and Stefano did those pages where it was like him flashing back to, you know, smelling his dad everywhere in the apartment and how your sense of smell connects to your memory.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that was something that I thought, you know, it would suck to be Matt Murdock because you can, you know, when Karen Page is dead, you're still smelling her on everything. You know, and
yeah.
It's like, because that can happen. You walk in someplace and you smell like some perfume that your girlfriend used to wear who, you know, dumped you 10 years ago, and suddenly you remember, like, every moment of your life with that person. And it's like, and that would be such a hardcore thing to deal with, you know, and that was why it was like, okay, you know, Matt meets Lily Luca, and
yes.
Lily smells like Karen Page. You know, something about her reminds him completely of Karen Page. She has the exact same scent. And it's like nobody besides Wolverine could you really do something like that with.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. That, and again, it was those shades that made your run very interesting. And you've left interesting pieces on the game board for Andy to pick up or others to pick up. So
yeah.
Much like you did in Iron Fist, like you were saying, you and Matt did the same thing in Iron Fist, and Dwayne had a field day, and that field day will continue.
You did a great job on that book. I'm not. I think there'll be more Iron Fist when the
one shots finish.
Yeah, the one shots with the other immortal weapons. Yeah. I think that's what you should do, you know, when you do a book, try to leave as many pieces there. I really hope, you know, that Mr. Fear comes back, because I was really happy with making Mr. Fear,
yes,
like, more of a badass Daredevil villain. And that was Ralph Macchio's idea. Ralph said that he never understood why Bullseye had become Daredevil's main nemesis when Bullseye first appeared, he was kind of a joke character, whereas Mr. Fear... You know, Daredevil's the man without fear, and Mr. Fear's the man who can make anyone be full of fear. And it's like, why isn't Mr. Fear his arch nemesis? So I was thinking about it, and I was like, yeah, I should, you know, Ralph was telling me that, and I started thinking about it, and I'm like, yeah, it'd be kind of cool if Mr. Fear, actually, because Mr. Fear is also a guy who went to college with Matt Murdock. You know, Mr. Fear, like, was at law school with Matt and like, hated Matt ever since then because Matt was, like, the golden child.
Sure.
And, you know, he figured out that Matt Murdock was Daredevil, you know, before anybody else did. And, you know, so it's like, yeah, this guy's kind of cool, actually. There's a lot to this guy. So that was a really fun arc to do, too, where Mr. Fear, you know, basically destroyed Matt's life and, you know, Mila pushed the guy in front of a train.
No, absolutely. You put your stamp on the character, man, and it was a fun ride, and I'm sorry that it's ended, but I can appreciate why you've chosen to end the way it is with your schedule. And also, again, it's better to leave, you know, and have people missing you than, you know, being sick of you. And I think,
yeah,
you know, the only person I think that really managed to, like, have a good run, you know, I mean, Frank, as we've talked about before, and Brian has mentioned it too, you know, Frank not only closed the door, he nailed it shut on his run of Daredevil. I mean, it was the end.
He didn't actually do all that much. When you go back and you read his issues, I mean, he did, you know, I think I did more issues of Daredevil than he did.
There you go. And I mean, and Anicetti had the thankless job of having to follow him, and luckily was able to kind of, you know, keep the quality of the book going. You know,
yeah.
And I was happy to see her come back in 500. And I know a lot of people, I've been hearing that at conventions all the time, people asking Joe Quesada, whatever happened to Anicetti? How come she doesn't write anymore for Marvel? So it was nice that she was brought back.
Yeah, she's. I think she wrote a movie that's getting filmed right now too.
Oh, very cool.
Or maybe just got filmed. She, like, some comedy movie starring Justin Long, actually. I know, which seems weird.
Well, I mean, well, no weirder than I had heard that. And is this true that she was writing for High Times?
I think she was an editor there. I'm not 100% sure.
There
on
you
that.
Go. I got no problem with that.
Her.
I just think it's interesting. No, I understand. And yeah, she had been out of comics for so long. It was just nice to see her back, much like Roger Stern coming back in the Cap issue too. So
I know exactly. It's I thought that was cool. Yeah, she did an incredibly long run on that book too.
Yeah.
You know, and she did a ton of different stuff with Daredevil than anyone else had ever done before.
Typhoid Mary and stuff like that. I mean, you know,
Sending him to hell, actually.
Well, all right, every now and then.
Yeah, exactly.
Oops, but that's okay. You know, we forgive her. Well, dude, I look up and I see that we've been once again talking for 2 hours. And as always, I appreciate when we fall into this depth of conversation, but also feel like I'm, you know, wearing out my welcome. So,
got to go watch Jeeves and Wooster.
Yeah.
My wife and I are watching all the Jeeves and Woosters over again.
Oh, that's cool. Very nice.
I recently watched all of Rome season one again, and after that I was like, I need something a little more uplifting.
great Hugh Laurie and Stephen Fry series, if people haven't seen it. Very funny stuff.
It totally cracks me up. Oh, and let me recommend a crime thing to you.
Please.
If you've got, I'm sure you've got an all-region player, and somewhere in your town will be one of those video stores that rents all-region, you know, imports and stuff.
But okay.
I stumbled across this Australian crime drama called Underbelly, and it is, like, it's pretty amazing. It's hard to be able to judge it because I haven't seen a lot of Australian TV, but it is so much harder core than anything that has been broadcast on American or BBC.
Cool.
Like, it is, like, harder core than The Sopranos and The Wire. And
wow.
It chronicles 10 years. I've only seen the first series. There's a second one, apparently. But it chronicles a 10-year drug war in, I think, Melbourne, Australia. And it's based on fact. There was, like, a book written about this period from the early 90s through, like, the early part of the 21st century. And, you know, all the characters who are in it are based on real people. Like, they're using their real names. And there's, like, an area in Australia where they weren't even allowed to show the show because a couple of the people in it are still up for appeal. And it is basically about these various crime families who are trying to take over, like, the drug trade, and some guy who's sort of this up-and-coming guy who starts out as, like, a gopher who ends up taking over, like, most of the city's drug trade. And it's really interesting because it's about the sort of the changing time between the old guard and the new guard in sort of the organized crime and crime family underworld of Australia. So it's really amazing in some ways. And also, more violence and nudity and swearing than you've ever seen on an American TV show. Like, literally not an episode goes by without, like, 48 breasts.
Outstanding.
I was just like, oh, my God. Like, I'm watching this, and I'm like, was this on cable over there? And it's like, no, it was broadcast at 8 o'clock. And I'm like,
oh, Mr. Rogers
is so much cooler than America.
That's awesome. That's
great. Yeah, Underbelly. I got it. It's available through Amazon UK, I know.
Okay.
And I rented it from Scarecrow Video here in Seattle, and because they get everything.
Sure.
But, yeah, if you've got, like, one of those crazy, you know, we get everything video stores.
Oh, yeah.
Out, Underbelly. And there's a second series that they made, and they're already working on a third one. And the second series is like a flashback that takes place in the 70s, so I'm totally dying to see that.
Oh, that's really cool. Now,
yeah, but, the original one, I ended up, like, doing a bunch of research about the people who were in it, because I was just like, these are all real people, so I went online and looked up a lot of them, and they actually kind of look like the people who play them in the shows, even.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's really fun. Some of the acting is really amazing, and It's really, you don't read too much about the characters while you're watching the show because you might find out when one of them gets killed. But very few people survive the show, I'll tell you that. The character who I thought was going to be the main character in the show doesn't get past episode 2.
Wow.
So yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's really according to everything I read about it, it's considered one of the better things that's ever been made for Australian TV, other than this thing that was made in the 90s that was about a corrupt police squad, which makes me really want to find that, because I'm like, wow, in the 90s, in the early 90s, Australia was doing, like, a miniseries based on, like, a corrupt police squad. Like, this Australian TV is something worth looking at, apparently.
You know, and I felt that way about Charlie Jade, this South African sci-fi alternate universe show that, like, Sci-Fi Channel buried at 2 in the morning. And
oh,
it's,
my God, I've never even heard of it.
You know, it's not perfect, but there were enough good ideas about it, and just the locale made it very interesting to me.
Charlie Jade.
And I've even seen it at a couple of the conventions on the bootleg video tables.
Yeah,
where
wow.
You know, they didn't finish. They only did one season. But it was very interesting, and it was made for South African television. And a film that I want to recommend to you that I saw the same weekend as Inglourious Basterds, a Dutch film called Flame and Citron. And I thought
it was excellent. Good?
I liked it. It's European slow.
Yeah, I know all about it. I there was sometime recently I was going to look at that. Either it's on Netflix or somewhere else had it streaming online.
And, well, Comcast has it on their on-demand channels until
Maybe
October.
That's it. Maybe it was on Movies on Demand or something. But, yeah, I heard that was really good.
Yeah, it is. And, I mean, and again, it was perfect to watch right after Inglourious Basterds because it was the Dutch resistance fighting Nazis.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, it's definitely got a European pace to it as opposed to an American film, but a lot of action, and I was very impressed with how well it was shot, and I thought the characterization was very cool, and I recommend it. Flame and Citron.
What do you think of Inglourious Basterds?
Oh, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot.
I really liked it. I was expecting it to be a completely different movie than it actually was.
How so?
Like, Brad Pitt's probably in it for 15 minutes, and
yeah.
You know, I thought it was going to be much more about them than it was. It was much more of a structured ensemble kind of
true.
story the way all of his things are, but I felt like it was really interesting because a lot of people will say that Jackie Brown is his most mature movie in a lot of ways. And, you know, like it's a movie that's more like an old man movie kind of. And,
yes.
Which I agree with, but Jackie Brown and Reservoir Dogs are my favorite Tarantino movies. And I felt like this one was somewhere in between like the sort of crazy, you know, will do anything kid Tarantino and like the mature Tarantino. Like I felt like this was definitely in a lot of ways a really mature work, the way it was filmed and the way it was written. And I got a lot more out of it than I was expecting to in some ways. Like it wasn't bullshit, and the previews kind of made it look like it was going to be some bullshit.
Yeah, I understand what you mean, and I think you're right. And man, Christoph Waltz, my God. I mean, I used to think Otto Preminger was like the greatest Nazi ever on celluloid, and I got to say, move over because
That guy was amazing.
Yeah,
and I mean, I read some interview with Tarantino where he's saying that it almost ruined the movie, like, or it almost like scotched the film, like writing that character because it's like you needed a guy who could speak English, French, German, and Italian. And like he was the last guy to walk in.
Oh wow.
And it's like, oh yeah, I can speak all those languages. It's like, oh good, you're hired.
He was on Adam Carolla's podcast, Christoph Waltz.
Oh,
and,
really?
Yeah, and really, what an interesting guy. And also, I am fascinated by the German film and television industry, because even he was saying that things are really made first for television and for the German national television more so than really for cinema. And and that was his real background. And, yeah, a very interesting actor and just an incredible performance. And, God, you always hate to – you feel like an idiot in the summer, you know, calling for Oscar nominations and stuff. But, really, this guy, I think, is going to be the guy to beat in the Best Supporting Role. I mean, he really is.
He won at Cannes, right? He won Best Actor.
Makes sense.
Or something. So, yeah, he was fantastic and just, you know, such a smarmy guy. Like, and I just loved, though, that, you know, Tarantino had the balls to, like, write a, you know, do the same kind of shit with World War II that Leone did with whatever wars were taking place in his westerns. Like, you never know what war it is.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, he just used World War II for the hell of it almost.
Well, and even naming...
And it's like, I love that, like, that, you know, it's like, oh, we're going to kill Hitler here in this theater. Okay. If you haven't seen the movie, that's a spoiler.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and also just even Brad Pitt's character, who I thought was at first named Aldo Ray, and I didn't hear the N at the end of his name, and I'm like, oh, Aldo Rain. Okay, fine.
Yeah, because Aldo Ray was like an old World War II actor, right?
Exactly. It's like, yeah, I'm Sergeant Spencer Tracy. Nice to meet you. It's like, you know,
Sergeant
okay.
Tracy Spencer. Yeah, I know. It's funny. In Criminal, Tracy... Lawless and his brother Rick are actually named after Spencer Tracy and Broderick Crawford.
Oh, that's funny.
Broderick and Tracy are their names.
Oh, that's very cool. But and also loved, God, the French woman who owned the cinema or ran the cinema, she was incredible.
Oh, she's fucking amazing. Yeah. I know, I want to put her in everything. Like, I couldn't believe how great she was. And those scenes where the guy's, like, flirting with her, you almost feel sorry for that Nazi guy, and then he turns out to be a complete prick. You know, but it was like when he's, like, at the cafe and she's just, like, trying to, like, get him to leave her alone. Like, there's some great filmmaking in that movie. I was really, I mean, it did not feel, in a lot of ways, like a Tarantino movie to me. It felt like, you know, in the same way that you watch, you know, No Country for Old Men and it doesn't feel like a Coen Brothers movie. It's like he's comfortable enough as a filmmaker now that he doesn't have to put flourishes on his movies. You know, it's like he's comfortable enough with himself and what he does that he doesn't need to sort of, you know, give it a sort of signature move or something.
Yeah,
you know,
play
it's
the
like,
type.
You know, yeah, I like that, you know. I liked that it was, I mean, he did the chapters, and, you know, that's such a Tarantino kind of thing to do, but at the same time, you know, I just thought it showed a lot of courage as a filmmaker to do it the way he did, and it showed a lot of, you know, comfort in the fact that, you know, he knows what he's doing, and that was more than anything else made me feel like, okay, now I can't wait to see what this guy does next.
Right,
you know,
exactly, yeah.
Like,
No, the
and, you know, he keeps talking about how he's not going to make movies, you know, when he's old, like he's going to retire at like 55 or 60 or something. And I'm like, well, you better start fucking making more movies quicker then.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, like, you know, 50 is, you know, 50 is today's 30.
and being close to 45, I would agree.
Yeah,
I certainly
like,
hope
I don't
so.
Wanna, I don't want to, it's like, what is he, he's like 40, 46 or 47
yeah, he's,
years old.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, dude, you're going to have to make a lot more movies because, you know, but he's made a lot in the last few years, so.
Yeah, that's true.
That's a good sign.
Yeah, Grindhouse was only like 2 years ago or whatever, so.
Yeah, and he took too long in between Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown, basically, and then too long between Jackie Brown and Kill Bill. But, you know, he's just, you know, if he turns out a movie every year like Woody Allen, I'll be fine if he retires at 60.
Exactly, because, God, you don't want Scoop. That was, dude, I love Woody Allen, but my God, that was just sad.
Yeah, I couldn't make it all the way through that one.
I'm
apparently one of the few people who likes the one with Colin Farrell and Ewan McGregor.
I still haven't seen it.
I really like that one.
Is that Vicky
it's
Barcelona?
Much more along the lines of Match Point.
Was that Vicky Barcelona?
No, I haven't seen Vicky Cristina Barcelona yet, which I hear is really great, actually.
And so have I.
I can't believe I haven't watched a movie where Scarlett Johansson and Penelope Cruz make out, but
yeah, no
I haven't.
Yay.
Maybe that's why. You know, it's like, okay, you know, I don't really need to see that. I've seen that in my head before.
Which was the Colin Farrell...
I can't remember what it was called. It was the one he made before Vicky Cristina Barcelona. It was...
Match Point.
Yeah, after Match Point and after Scoop.
Yes.
Definitely. It was the one right after Scoop. It was Ewan McGregor and Colin Farrell are brothers, and it's another sort of Hitchcock thriller kind of movie, but a lot of people really didn't like it, but I really enjoyed it. It's, you know, it's a twisted crime story again, and it's got humor in it, but I thought they were both really great in it, actually. And
cool.
I'm one of those guys. I'm really excited. I just read the script for London Boulevard, which is Monahan's adaptation of a Ken Bruin novel, and it's going to be Monahan's first movie that he's directing, actually.
Kevin or Tom? Which Monahan?
William Monahan. He adapted a Ken Bruin novel, and he's directing it, too. And, you know, it's his feature debut as a director. But Colin Farrell and Keira Knightley are starring in it, and I read the script, and it's just amazing. And to me, as I was reading the script, I just kept picturing Colin Farrell. And I'm just like, finally Colin Farrell has decided to be in good movies. You know, it's like in Bruges, this, like, I think he's really going to experience this part of his career where he's just making good movies now.
That's cool.
Yeah, everyone goes through that phase when they're like whoever the it actor is.
Oh, yeah.
They're not allowed to be in movies that don't suck, apparently. To me, that's just like, all right, that's what I want to hear. The script for that is amazing, and if the movie's half as good as the script, it's going to be, you know, up there in the running next year for like best movie, because I just loved it. I've rarely read a movie script where I was just like, I can't wait to see this movie.
Very cool. Now, and very quickly, because I don't want to keep you too long. It's too late for that. But Angel of Death, we didn't even talk about it. And I know you had the big San Diego push for it as well. The DVD is out now. It was great to see it on Spike too, by the way.
Oh yeah, I didn't get to. I my TiVo broke, so I didn't get to actually see the TV edited version. What did they do? Did they just bleep out the swearing, or did they just blank it?
I really am blanking. I don't remember.
I heard that they left in the knife in the head. Which
they absolutely
glad.
Did.
There was apparently talk early on that they might have to cut out the whole thing with her and the knife in the
head.
Oh, that's... Like, well, that's the whole movie.
I was going to say, yeah, they had to keep that in. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, tell me, is there a chance that we'll see more of this, with you and Sony?
I don't know, actually. I haven't heard... I think we'll... They operate on a different schedule out in Hollywood, and I think once DVDs come out, I don't know how long they wait before they see what sales on a DVD are like. I know it sold pretty well at first, and I haven't really followed up on it too much just because I've been so busy with other work, but it's interesting. I've really, you know, looking at it since the feature version came out, I really have kind of come to realize that, you know, I think if we do a sequel, I want to try and make the chapters a little bit longer, because I feel like the original script was longer than what we ended up filming, and I feel like because it was released episodically on the internet, the episodes ended up being, they were originally going to be like 11 or 12 minutes long each, and they ended up being closer to 8 minutes long each. And I think because of that, it really, you know, it's just really, it's an interesting thing. It's different than comics where you're doing like chapters and chapters that, that then get collected. It's a similar theory, but because of that, there's some stuff that you don't end up doing. You know, film just works a little bit differently than comics. You can't immediately go to like a flashback or this or that when you're doing something that's in chapters. And so there's, you know, with everything you're learning about it. But I think if we do another one, you know, I'll try to do a little bit more layering to the story and things like that, because I think things that worked well when you watched it on the episode by episode basis, I think, you know, ultimately when you're doing something that's episodic, the episodes themselves are what's important. And, you know, I was trying to make something that both the episodes and the overall thing were equally important. And I think ultimately the episodes end up being a little bit more important. And, you know, so I want to, you know, if we do another one, I want to try and, you know, meet that challenge a little bit better than I did the first time, maybe. But, okay. You know. It's my own. It's one of those things where it's like I'm probably the only one who will notice.
Yeah.
But I look at everything like that, and I just feel like I wish that there was, about three or four more scenes that were written, or that I wish that I had written, you know, a few things here or there that made the story a little bit more fleshed out. But, you know, it's so cool to see it anyway. It really does feel like we went and made a Grindhouse movie. You know, it's
absolutely.
Like, you know, it's definitely got that drive, and Zoe's so great in it, and you know, everyone just really brought their all to it. And it's like, I just am hypercritical of my own stuff all the time, so I just, like, I've seen Angel of Death so many times now that now I only see the things about it that I don't like, which
right.
is how I look at most of my comics.
No, you know,
it's like I only see the parts where I'm like, oh.
Remender and I were having the same conversation last week about how a lot of times when you're doing something creatively and then you see it when it's done, all you can do is look at the warts and you can't appreciate the good stuff. Well, as someone who didn't write it, let me tell you that it was good to see that the energy was still there in its full length as it was episodically. At least it felt that way to me. And I like that. I hope this is an indication that more, you know, movies like this can be made and will be made with these different platforms, as opposed to, you know, traditionally hoping for so many, you know, screens and then eventually making it to a cable station and then worrying about DVD. So, you know, with online and all that.
I like the format a lot. I just think that you listen to people everybody who tells you what people want to see on the internet are not people who actually use the internet.
Exactly.
You know, I was literally watching an interview earlier today. Dwayne Swierczynski has a book that's coming out like tomorrow or something like that. That's a co-production with the guy who created CSI, and it's this thing called a Digibook. And I can't remember what it's called, like Level 29 or something like that, or Level 26. And Dwayne was twittering about it earlier today, so I went and read about it. And he mentioned it to me a while ago when he first got the gig, and it's basically like he collaborated with the story, it was this idea they brought to him, and they said, we want to do this thing as a novel where at certain parts in the novel, there'll be a code, and when you get to that part, it's like the end of a section, and then there'll be like and now you go online and you type in this code, and then when you do that, you watch this like 3 minute long video that then shows you the next part of the story, and then you flip the page and go on, because some parts of it are better to see instead of to read, is the theory. So it's a real multimedia thing, and it's by the guy who, you know, created CSI, and he wanted to try to create something that used, you know, publishing and the internet and filmmaking all in one package. And it's really interesting idea, but he was saying in his interview, he said, you know, most people, when they're sitting there in front of their laptop, don't want to watch something for more than 2 or 3 minutes. And I don't know where everyone has gotten this idea, and I feel like the people who are telling me that are not people who spend very much time at their computer or don't use the internet in the way that I and other people that I know, and much more the younger generation than mine even,
yep,
do, where they will spend all day on the internet.
Yes.
And the only time that they spend 2 or 3 minutes watching something is when it becomes boring after 2 or 3 minutes. They are fine watching, like, an hour-long show on Hulu.
Yeah.
You know, and they will sit and watch TV all day long on the internet if it's a show that they like, you know. And this idea that everything on the internet needs to be in 1 to 3 minute long chunks or 5 minute long chunks, or that there's this cutoff time where people suddenly are like, ah, this is too long to be spending on the internet. It's like, I don't know who comes up with those, like, theories, but they are clearly not people who have the kind of free time that most of the people who waste their day on the internet do, because, like, I've literally watched 2 hours worth of shit on Hulu today, and I did, like, 2 phone conferences, wrote comics, ran errands, and, you know, and I just did this interview with you, and
yes,
I still watched, like, 3 episodes of Better Off Ted with my wife over dinner.
Very good.
You know, and it's like, oh, Better Off Ted, great show. but literally, it's like, and, you know, and I'm in my 40s, you know.
I hear you.
Like, I'm not the internet generation. I didn't grow up with email, you know. So people who are really into the internet and the younger generation, these people that they're trying to reach with this stuff, we never heard a single word from anybody that Angel of Death was too short. You know, we had,
yes,
8, 9 minute long episodes. We could have easily had a 12 or 13 minute or 15 minute long. I never heard a single person say that Dr. Horrible was too long.
There you go.
It was 45 fucking minutes.
Yep.
You know, not a single person complained, oh, this is too long. I am sitting on the internet too long. Why isn't this released in 3 minute chunks? And I just, and not to mock the guy who wrote CSI, because, you know, he's probably a really talented guy, but he's also, like, 10 years older than me and probably doesn't spend a lot of time watching video on the internet.
Exactly.
You know? Well, and it's like, there's a fallacy here, and, you know, and until the movie studios and the TV studios realize that, they're going to be missing an entire market of people who, you know, I mean, now all the places have their own, you know, like, the local, like, satellite provider up here got in a conflict with whoever the ABC provider for this network is. So suddenly, for the last, like, a year, I haven't had ABC.
Interesting.
And that was the thing that made me start watching TV on the internet, because it was like, okay, well, you know, I want to watch Lost, I want to watch Castle, and, you know, so I would have to wait till the next day and watch them on ABC's website. But I can go on ABC's website and watch the whole show, and there's 4 commercials during that,
yep,
and I don't mind. And it's like with TiVo, I was never watching commercials because there's 8 commercials at every commercial break, and so you just fast forward through them all. But online, you know, I'll watch them, and, you know, I'm not, you know, maybe I'll mute a commercial if it's irritating or if it's the same commercial over and over again, but, you know, I would end up watching commercials, and I hadn't seen commercials for like a decade. So I was like, oh, okay, I'm watching Lost on the internet, and I'm watching, you know, other shows, anything that I like that's on ABC, I'm watching on the internet, and it didn't bother me at all. I have, like, a decent laptop. I have, you know,
good connection.
A lot of these shows, you know, now it's getting to the point where if you miss a TV show and you like it, you can go somewhere and download a, you know, an AVI file and plug a thumb, you know, transfer it to a thumbstick and hook it into your DVD player and watch it that way.
You're right.
And it's like, okay, like, you know, and until these places realize this is an audience, you know, and there's a lot of people who are, you know, appointment TV is over, you know, and it's going to be a really interesting time for the next few years until they actually figure out how to use this market to reach people. And I had read this article recently about how the reason people use pirate stuff, like the reason black market stuff and pirate stuff and all this stuff has always done so well in any time, in any market, you know, and the reason that, you know, bootleggers made money and, you know, like stuff like that. The reason that the illegal version of how you get stuff does so well generally is because they actually provide better service than the people who do it legally do.
Yep.
You know, like, the reason that LimeWire and whatever that, remember the music sharing site in the late 90s?
Napster?
Which one?
Napster.
Yeah, Napster. The reason those did so well is because they were highly efficient.
Yes.
You know, and until iTunes actually became efficient and had a lot of material, like, available, Napster was better.
That's exactly right.
Know? And it's like, and, but it's shocking. Like, I guess these giant corporations are just these really slow-moving behemoths. But they really seem to always arrive at all this stuff so late.
Well,
and
they...
so I'm watching this now with, like, Hulu. And it's like, okay, well, Hulu, obviously, you know, the networks all own that. And they're putting their own stuff on it. But they're, like, why don't they put a show on Hulu the same night that it's on TV? Why do they make people wait till the next day? What you're doing when you make people wait till the next day, or, God forbid, the next week, is all the people who would have watched that on Hulu are going to some other site and watching it illegally instead and not seeing the commercials that ABC or Fox or whoever is getting paid per hit to see. And
you're
it's
right.
Like, dude, the people who are going to watch it on Hulu were not going to watch it on TV to begin with. They're different people. You're not undercutting your market. Just like the people who, you know, those people who downloaded the cruddy version of Wolverine on the internet were not the same people who went and saw it in the theater anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
you're
obviously
right.
Not. You well, know, and it's like they're different audiences. And, you know, it took me a while to realize that. But once you realize it, it's just like, it's like a lightning bolt hitting you where you're like, almost anybody who would buy a book to put it on their Kindle is not the kind of person who wants to have a bookshelf full of books to begin with. You know, it's a different audience. You know, the people who have a Kindle who also are the kind of people who want to buy books, then the only things they're putting on their Kindle are stuff they need for traveling. You know, and they
sure.
don't want to carry books.
Sure.
But, you know, like Neil Gaiman is not going to stop buying books because he has a Kindle. You know, Felicia Day has a Kindle, but I doubt that she, you know, I'm sure there are still books she plans to buy.
I understand.
You know, and, but it really is shocking. And it's like, I'm glad that Sony, you know, made Angel of Death and that they are trying to tap into this market. But I feel like with all these corporations, every step they take is so tentative, and then they'll take a tentative step and then step back from it because they're like, oh, I don't know. You know, and it's
yes.
like, oh, maybe we're screwing ourselves on this. And, you know, all these corporations get so worried that they might make the wrong decision that they just don't make any. And when they don't make any, they allow those pirate sites and those pirate, you know, places to jump up. And, you know, I mean, imagine the amount of money we could have all been making on digital comics for the last several years. And, you know, all these people have been going to these pirate sites and downloading our work and reading it for free.
Sure.
And a vast majority of those people would have probably happily gone to iTunes and paid a dollar to download all those comics that they, you know, per issue to get better high-reser, you know, copies of them that were actually legal. I don't think most of the people who use those sites are really, like, thrilled that they're doing something illegal. I think, you know, probably a lot of them worry that they might get busted someday. You know, like
yeah.
especially if they're an adult. If they're a kid, probably they don't care about it. But adults that do that stuff would probably much more rather do it legally.
Certainly.
And, you know, that's the same, you know, the reason iTunes makes so much fucking money is because, you know, the people who used to use Napster or LimeWire or whatever are like, oh, I can just do this legally now. And, you know, $10 for a record isn't that big a deal.
I agree. Well, now,
yeah.
quickly, are your creator-owned properties, do you have the ability to kind of choose where you're going to put them digitally if you do decide to put them anywhere digitally?
I have to deal with Marvel on it, actually. I mean, that's part of my deal with Marvel.
Okay.
It gives them, you know, a bit of a say in that. I think it ultimately comes down to me, but I'm still going to wait and see how this stuff shakes out. I'm honestly, you know, I don't enjoy reading comics on a computer screen personally at all.
I agree.
Like, I barely can stand to look at color proofs and lettering corrections on the internet. So I'm probably not going to be a person who would be a customer for that stuff. And, you know, but I'm really hoping, you know, like I've just been saying, that it's a different audience. I'm really hoping that, you know, this doesn't become a thing where suddenly, you know, once stuff becomes available on the internet, people stop buying comics. Or, you know, what a lot of people are predicting is that monthly comics won't sell as well, but trade paperbacks will do better. And I'm like, I think you're just pulling that prediction out of your ass. I don't think any of us really know what the hell is going to happen. I can't imagine a world where people aren't still, you know, producing and reading comic books as physical objects. I mean, print is fairly cheap and fairly effective, and you know, I don't think there's any need for it to go away. I think, you know, it's going to be an interesting time. I mean, definitely the thing that appeals to me about the digital market is just the amount of people that you can reach that you can't reach, you know, who might be interested in what you do. I mean, the idea of, you know, going from selling 20,000 copies of Criminal to selling, you know, 20,000 copies of the comic and maybe reaching another 50,000 people through the digital, you know, would be pretty amazing. But, you know, it's ultimately, they're different packages and they're different objects. And, you know, I saw the long box demo. Like,
yes. Grant
gave us the special demo of it at Heroes Con. And it looks really cool and it seems like a really good package, and you know, clearly it's going to happen whether we want it to or not. So I feel like if it's going to happen whether we want it to or not, you know, we're all going to have to get on board eventually. I just you know, it's maybe because I'm just a print guy. Like, I mean, I'm sitting here in a room surrounded by books right now.
Sure.
Like, I just I kind of lament that people really feel that this is what needs to happen. You know, is that everything needs to be, you know, like, I'm not the guy who's ever going to buy a Kindle. You know, it's like, I like books. I'll just keep buying books. I'm sure they're going to keep selling books.
I agree. And the only thing I would say specifically for comics is I would be willing to try something at 99 cents an issue as a digital item versus, you know, the price point that we're at right now for the monthlies. And that's the only way.
How many people who buy, like, my comics or anyone's comics also buy the trade paperback? That's the thing that occurs to me. It's like, well, maybe, you know, if you're spending 99 cents to read a non-printed comic, buying the trade paperback, you know, doesn't seem like that big of a deal for double dipping.
Right.
Because you can't loan a Kindle to somebody. You can't loan your computer screen to somebody to read your comics.
True.
You know, it's a different experience, but, you know, that's one of the things that's great about books. You can loan them to your friends, you know. It's like,
absolutely.
Hey, look, it's this really handy thing. You turn the page and there's more stuff on the next one. You know, it's a really efficient little thing. It's been around for, you know, a couple thousand years.
Yeah.
So I don't think we're going to see the end of print, you know, anytime in our lifetime, because also, you know, you've got the danger of, you know, What if I walk into your house and set off an electromagnetic pulse? I've just wiped out your entire comics collection.
Oh man, yeah, that's gonna be shitty. No kidding.
Yeah, and you know, like, or if you wake up and Amazon has decided that, you know, they're not gonna sell Marvel comics anymore, and they've taken all the Marvel comics off of your Kindle and replaced them with a credit for Amazon. That's what they did with George Orwell books.
Did they really?
Did you hear about that?
No.
Oh, it was like a couple months ago. All these people woke up and their Kindle was missing. Anyone who'd bought, this was hysterical. It was Animal Farm in 1984 were taken off of people's Kindles.
That's appropriate.
The Orwell estate had decided they didn't want to sell electronic, you know, versions of the stuff. And so Amazon had to take them all back and credit people's accounts.
Hilarious.
So, yeah, it turns out when you buy something on a Kindle, you don't actually own it.
Wow.
So, yeah, that sucks, right?
Yeah.
So there's a, you know, when you buy a book, Amazon can't come to your house and take it back.
Interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, it's the difference between owning something and being able to hold it in your hands and, you know, being able to read something. I mean, the thing I think about is how many comics that I read every month that I don't keep, just because I read a lot of stuff on a consumer fan level that I don't want to really hold on to, because if I really love it, I'll buy the trade paperback anyway. And, you know, I'm not a comic collector in the same way that I was when I was a kid. And, you know, I have to read a certain amount of stuff just to sort of keep up with what's going on. And also, you know, because I follow a lot of my friends' stuff, but, you know, I also buy the trade paperbacks of their stuff, and then I'm, you know, need to get rid of the comics. And so, you know, the idea of having that, being able to follow the material that you don't necessarily want to own forever, you know, so that is, you know, one of the appeals of it, but it's sad, you know. I mean,
if
comics were sold, you know, a dollar, then, you know, we wouldn't feel that way. But, you know, I recently looked into because a lot of people always complain about comic prices and ask about, you know, printing on newsprint or this or that and
sure.
how cheaper it would be. I actually looked into it recently and found out it would only be 1 cent cheaper to print Criminal on newsprint than the paper we use now, which is like fucking 60 weight, like matte finish stock, which is really good paper. And newsprint, to print the entire book on that with like a glossy cover, would only be a penny cheaper a copy.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, newsprint's actually kind of pricey at this point. Like, that's really interesting. Like, I always assumed that newsprint would be much cheaper.
Certainly.
No, it's because of, you know, the you know, paper prices have gone up overall. Like, the better papers are more plentiful and cheaper now because, you know, that people have moved to using better papers over the years.
That's
so
crazy,
it's
man.
It's really kind of fascinating to see that, you know.
Because I remember telling you and Rucka that when I'd get Gotham Central, I liked it on the newsprint because it made Michael's art look more pulpy.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
yeah, I like newsprint, actually. I like the paper the Vertigo comics are printed on.
Yes. What do you think
I
of...
I would print the trade paperbacks on, like, better matte finish paper.
What do you think of Wednesday's comics that DC's been doing?
That's what made me, like, price it out, because I liked the look of that, and I wanted to find out how much, you know, newsprint costs. Because I was like, why is this 16-page thing $4? You know, it's 16 pages of comics. I mean, I know they're huge. I like it. I mean, it's weird. I feel like, you know, just like going back and trying to read old Sunday strips, it's like, it's actually harder to get into it than I want it to be.
Interesting.
Like, I like looking at it more than anything, but I feel like especially modern comic book writers have really forgotten, if they ever knew, the art of trying to write a story in a single page at a time where each page is actually enjoyable. A couple of them seem to pull it off, you know, and are having a lot of fun with the format. But, you know, I especially like the Commandy stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
You know, the one that reminds me the most of an actual old, you know, comic. But, yeah, it's a cool experiment. I feel like it's more of an artistic success than a story success so far.
I agree, and I agree with you, too. Commandy is a standout, and there are a few other obvious ones. Paul Pope's Adam Strange, is gorgeous. And, again, yeah, you know, it is
Paul
art
Pope
first.
Giant-sized stuff before any of them. know, this may have been Paul Pope's idea for all we know.
Carl Kershaw's Flash has been, like, the pleasant surprise.
That's another one where I feel like he's really taken advantage of the format, doing the two different strips.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm wondering how they're going to collect this stuff eventually.
Yeah.
Like, are they going to collect them all, like, where you have all the Commandy strips next to each other and all the, you know, is this going to go on for a whole year?
Oh, no, it's only 12, it's only 12 issues.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's only a 12-week event. Yeah. Yeah, we're on the last legs of it now.
Oh, Jesus, I didn't realize it was that short. I thought it was going to be like a year-long thing.
Oh, no.
Oh, now I'm disappointed.
I'm sorry, man.
I go from being like, oh, it's not a success, to, oh, no, I'm disappointed it's over. But it seems like they did pretty well with it, though.
Oh, yeah, I have a feeling. Well, and it's up to Chiarello if he wants to, you know, kind of wrangle everybody together again.
Yeah, I hope when they put out the collection of it that they do like an oversized and that they put all the strips among each other instead of making you, you know, flip through, you know, 16. Like, I'd love to have all the Commandees next to each other and all the Adam Stranges.
Oh, know, yeah.
Together, and you know, because they are telling one big story, hopefully. So
definitely,
I think that would be the way to do it, but. Yeah, well, that'll be a lot. That'll be a big book, actually, when you think about it. It'll be like 180 pages or something.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a lot of material to put together.
I've heard people say they want to see it be the size of the Little Nemo, you know, gigantic.
Oh, God, yeah. I somehow can't see DC putting it out that big, but I never would have seen DC doing Wednesday comics either. So
you know.
I wish Darwin had done something for that. I think that would have been really great to see what he would have done with that space.
Hey, and you know, and forgive me, Ed, because I know I'm taking we're you know doing our usual marathon again, but I got to ask because so many crime products have come out, and you briefly mentioned that you're going to be reprinting your interview with Darwin.
Oh yeah,
that you and Tom Spurgeon did. What do you think of Parker and Dirty Money and some of the crime novels that have come out lately?
I haven't read the Vertigo crime stuff yet. I'm really interested in that. I'm a big fan of Ian Rankin's too.
Me too.
And you know, obviously, I'm a fan of Azzarello's stuff. I'm just haven't been to the comic store lately. But yeah, I mean, I'm psyched to see them doing that line. It's funny. It's like I think 7 years ago or so, like Will Dennis was first talking to me about them doing a line like that, and I know Brian was going to do one, and I was going to do one, and I actually put together a pitch for something that me and Jason Lutz were going to do.
Wow.
A graphic novel, and Warren Ellis was going to do one, I know, and they were going to be smaller than they are now as far as page count goes,
okay.
I think, and they weren't going to be hardbacks. But I like the format that they're doing, so I hope that they do well with it. And I think with Vertigo's bookstore distribution, you know, that but I'm really looking forward to the Azzarello one. The Hunter, you know, I just loved.
Me too.
I got to see early copies of that, you know, as Darwin was working on it. Scott would send me stuff whenever Darwin would send in a big batch of stuff, and you know, that's why I wanted to help them promote it, and you know, just because I think it's so cool looking, and it's easily the best art Darwin's ever done, and you know, he just to know that he did every line on that page, and you know, even the lettering and all that blue stuff wasn't done on an overlay; those are actually full color reproductions. He actually drew all that blue on there.
That's what I heard. Yes.
So yeah, it's pretty amazing, and you know. It doesn't hurt that he's adapting, you know, one of the best crime novels ever.
You bet. Absolutely.
But I think he did a pretty ballsy adaption of it, too, like doing the first, you know, like 30 pages, basically, or 20 pages or whatever it was as a silent piece.
Yes.
Was pretty amazing. And, yeah, I was really impressed with it. And, you know, sounds like his plans for the next one are even more ambitious, so I'm really psyched to see him doing that stuff and you know, getting away from... Because he's wanted to do that kind of stuff forever. I mean, he's the one who started talking about the Parker novels when we were first starting to work on Catwoman. He was mentioning those books, and I hadn't read those books. You know, I'd read a couple of the Parker books a long time ago, and I totally forgot about them. And then I went and tracked some down in a used bookstore and started reading them again. And you know, and then ended up like going on eBay and like recently, you know, I guess a few years ago, like buying every single one of them. Because I became obsessed, and you know, so that was definitely one of those things. I was really, you know, when he got that gig, I was really psyched about it. And I talked to him and Scott Dunbier about arranging an interview. I was going to interview both him and Westlake, and to talk about, you know, the project and to talk about the history of the character and everything. I was really like looking forward to that, partially just as an excuse to finally talk to Donald Westlake, as you know, him and Vonnegut and
wow.
You know, Ross McDonald and a few other people are basically like, you know, the biggest influences on, you know, whatever it is that I do.
Cool.
And I really just kind of wanted an excuse to talk to him. And then, you know, he died on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Just like, and, you know, and then I was talking to Darwin when we were doing our interview and found out like Darwin had sent him a package of stuff. And he emailed Darwin back to say, "Oh, I'm in Mexico. I'll look at it when I get home." And so he never actually even saw any of the work Darwin was doing, other than the initial designs. And you know, I mean, they had some talks and emailed, and you know, he was consulting on the book and was like a fan of Darwin's work and stuff. But he never got to actually see any of the book, apparently.
Yeah, heartbreaking. I've heard Darwin tell that story as well.
Yeah. So yeah, it's sad.
Yeah.
But you know, it's good to see Darwin's going to keep doing the books. And, you know, his plan, I think, for the next one is he's going to take the next two books and sort of take the part of the Man with the Getaway Face that is necessary to the outfit and then adapt the outfit. So, like, he'll use, you know, a chunk of the Man with the Getaway Face, and that'll sort of be like the prologue to the next book, actually.
Right.
So, sounds really ambitious to, you know, but it's good that he's willing to do that stuff and not just be slavishly, you know, devoted to, you know, just I'm going to adapt this book and then I'm gonna, like, I like that he's got, you know, the balls to play around with the adaptions, because, you know, you can go read the books if you just want to read the book. This is the, you know, he should, you know, do something different when you're adapting it, you know, other than, you know, obviously be true to the spirit of it, but but, you know, have some fun, too.
Absolutely. And I hope, and forgive the mixing of metaphors, but I really think that, you know, this can be a Jackie Robinson kind of breakthrough product, The Hunter. And, you know? I know.
Wow.
But
what
yeah,
I mean, it really does feel like suddenly there's like a bunch of crime stuff coming out.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think, again.
The Vertigo crime. I pray that the Vertigo crime line is more successful than their, you know, girls line.
Yeah, or Piranha Press, you know, 10 years ago as well. I mean
they've tried all this stuff, but they have a much better bookstore distribution arm than they had then. And I think, you know, what I heard about the God, I can't remember the name of it now. That's how quick it came and went. The teen girl graphic novel.
Oh, Minx. Minx, right?
Yeah, the Minx line. When that sort of, I got the impression from reading about why it was ending so abruptly was that, you know, the bookstores didn't know where to put the books. And, you know, on these, it's pretty obvious you'll put them in the crime section.
Absolutely.
You know, so hopefully that will help them, you know, be able to get that bigger market penetration that they can get with the Minx line.
Could you foresee doing a similar, you know, hardcover dressing of the criminal stuff that you're doing?
Probably not as, like, an original book, you know, but definitely. I mean, Sean actually recently went and made two copies of Coward as like a little hardback book and sent one to me and you know kept one for himself, and he likes the idea of you know at some point down the line like reprinting, you know, maybe when we've got like the first five books out or something, like reprinting them as like these little black and white hardbacks and you know not even using the color in them and you know just doing that as maybe like a bookstore edition or something. And I don't know. We'll see. It looks really cool. It's cool to see it like a little bit smaller, and you know his lettering's big enough that you can still read it. But yeah, he was referring to them as the noir editions because they're in black and white.
Oh, very cool. Well, that's cool.
But yeah, it's pretty cool. I don't know how many times you can get away with repackaging the same material is the only thing I fear.
I understand. Well, but and also I
so it works for Walking Dead.
Just talk to Robert. And the only reason why I said, and that was my point with making the bad metaphor with Jackie Robinson and The Hunter, but that's the thing. I really think that's a good initial book to kind of warm people up. I think Vertigo's Crime Line will continue that, and I would say that what you guys are doing with Criminal could stand next to that stuff, and I really do hope it opens the market more for traditional readers to really do look at graphic novels. I mean, Sin City and Hellboy, you know, did a good job. And I think Road to Perdition even turned on a few more people. But that's the thing. I really think now there is such a great amount of crime, good crime comics out there to be exploited and get this new audience.
Yeah, I hope that's one of the things I really hope about the Disney stuff is that we start getting, you know, better bookstore distribution on that stuff, because I feel like, you know, I still feel like, you know I get out to some bookstores and I get, you know, a decent amount of bookstore sales for the criminal books, but I sell far more through the comic stores. You know, I sell the bulk of the you know trades that we sell are sold through the comic stores, and that's great, but I feel like, you know, there's people who aren't going into comic stores who would dig the criminal books.
Hell yeah.
You know, they aren't finding them. Like, I go into Barnes & Noble, you know, like probably every week because it's at where the movie theater is, and you know they've got a huge amount of graphic novels and they don't carry any of the criminal books, and I'm like, what did I like pick on the Barnes and Noble buyer in high school or something? Like, what's going on here? Like, why do you got like every Vertigo graphic novel but none of mine? Like, you know, and I you know, obviously I need to go to one of these book fairs and put the books right into his hands and go, hey, have you ever heard of this book? but you know, it is one of those things where, you know, I'm thankful for the, you know, the market that I do have.
Sure.
But you know, yeah, I'd like to see some more of that stuff out there more, and you know, I hope that the books are all good, because you know we don't need more bad graphic novels getting into bookstores that, you know, make people think that comics suck.
Exactly, because they don't, and you know you're one of the reasons why they don't suck. So that's good. Now, when does the next Criminal arc begin?
goes to print next week, I think. So it'll be out either the end of September or first week of October or something like that. I can't remember what the actual print is.
Is the omnibus out yet, or is it?
No, the omnibus comes out in November. It was advance solicited. So
okay.
We're printing it in China.
Okay.
The China printing, they literally put it on a slow boat, apparently, and that's why it takes, you have to advance solicit everything.
No problem. So that's in November, and forward to more in the Marvels project and whatever else comes down the pipe.
Project, 8 issues in, it will be, so that'll be coming out for the foreseeable future.
Fantastic.
And I have a special Cap 1 shot coming out in December as well that follows Reborn. I don't know if I'm allowed to reveal the title of it yet. But,
okay.
That comes out, and then also in December, Cap 602, I think, comes out also in December. That's the beginning of the next Captain America storyline, which is called Two Americas.
Excellent. 50s Cap.
Yeah, well, 50s Cap is in it, that's for sure.
Okay.
He's one of the Americas.
Interesting.
He's the Cap for the birthers.
Nice.
Crazy people who don't think Obama was born in America.
Yeah.
Those crazy people who don't have health care, who also don't want any.
Hey, really quickly, Gene Colan, working in with him on 599?
Oh, yeah, that was great. I haven't spoken to him for a long time now. Last time I called over there, I ended up talking to his wife instead. That was fantastic. And I it was supposed to be a Cap annual, and they released it as 601 instead.
Oh, 601, okay.
Yeah, and which, basically it was just a standalone, Cap annual, but
yeah.
They called it Cap 601 instead. And I noticed some people were mad about that. They were like, why wasn't this an annual? Why was this called 601? This has nothing to do with what's happening in Captain America Reborn. It's like, yeah, no, it doesn't at all. But we sold a lot of copies, so I'm fine.
Well, and I loved it, man. And I loved the black and white version of it, too. I thought that was really
great.
Yeah, I got
one of each, too.
Yes.
I was like, usually I'll only buy one copy, but I bought one of each of those because I was just like, oh, this thing is awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Gene's stuff was amazing. And he claims he's retired now. Like, that's the last comic he'll ever draw.
Wow.
So that's pretty amazing, like, considering he was, one of the first comic artists I ever read as a kid, so... Yeah, he's amazing. Got to give it up for the guy. I mean, he's probably drawn better comics than that before, and he's probably done better art than that before at some points. But he's a guy who has partial vision in one eye, and that comic was, and he's, like, really sick, and he spent a year or two, like, drawing that book, and it's still fucking amazing. Like, his pencils are so elegant. The line that he gets is so amazing. And, and it's funny, too, because he did, even though I worked from I gave him a full script, there's a few sequences here or there where he just added some stuff, like Marvel style. And so I had to go back in and, like, write some stuff on top of that because I was like, oh, wow, I didn't write this. I wonder what's going on here. And so it really gave me the impression of what it must have been like back in the day to work with Gene Colan.
Absolutely.
Okay, Gene, who are these guys in Dracula?
Well, there's that.
I just thought I'd do this thing where these guys show up and try to kill him. Okay.
He told me, I know he's told this story before, but when he was inspired by Bullet to put that great Cap in the Skull and Cars sequence back in the late
60s. Oh, yeah.
And that, Stan went nuts on him and said, you can't have this many pages of a driving scene. Are you nuts? And it was Gene trying to do the Bullet scene and everything. I thought that was great. So, no, he's
great. He's a fantastic guy, too.
Absolutely.
Like, to talk to. He's just got tons of stories. And, he's an old movie nut. And
oh, yeah.
Theater nut. And, he's a real character. So
fantastic, man.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well,
it was an honor to work with the guy.
And it showed in the story. Again, I agree. I think a man that if this is his last book, I'm glad that he had the chance to work with you and get back to Captain America because he put his stamp on the character as well.
Yeah. He didn't remember. That was what was really funny. He remembered that he'd drawn the book, but he didn't think he'd drawn that many issues of it because he was also doing, like, two other monthlies for Marvel
sure.
at the time. He was drawing Daredevil part-time then, too, because they were both bi-monthly. And drawing, like, Dracula, like, not long after that.
Right.
So, like, he remembers Dracula more than any of those because he drew so many issues of it. But,
sure.
Like, he called me up and he's like, so Captain America's origin, what is that again? Because he had to draw the scene with the origin. And he's like, he just, like, worked out a lot, right? And I was like, no. I thought that was really funny I just assumed he knew Captain America's origin. I was like, Gene, you drew the book for, like, 4 years. He's like, yeah, I was in the 60s, man. I thought that was really funny.
Fantastic, man. Well, dude. All
right.
As
cool,
always,
man. Well, I'll talk to you later. Thanks for having me on for so long.
And we'll look forward to new product. We appreciate it, Ed.
All right. Cool. I'll talk to you later, man.
Always good to catch up with Ed Brubaker, and that'll wrap up this edition of the Brubaker Testimony here on Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. A couple notes on the show coming up. The Baltimore Comic-Con will be happening. Comic-Con is happening October 10th and 11th. Look for me. I'll be roaming the aisles and moderating a panel. I'll give you more information on that as it gets firmed up. That'll be coming up in October along with another slew of great guests right here on Word Balloon. Thanks for listening. John Sutcher's reminding you that Word Balloon is all over the internet. Come to our website, wordballoon.com, for our full archive of past interviews with creators of comics, television, film, animation, games. It's all there waiting for you at wordballoon.com and at newsarama.com. Make sure you check out our shows that are posted over there. You can find us at iTunes as well. There's a new feature at wordballoon.com called Word Balloon University. A lot of my earliest 2005 and early 2006 shows are going to be posted there. The link is available at wordballoon.com. Currently posted, I've got 4 shows. My first conversations with Max Collins, Rags Morales, and Brian Bendis among the guests that you'll find at Word Balloon University under wordballoon.com. And any questions or comments about the show, visit the Word Balloon message board at wordballoon.com, which is sponsored by Jinx World, or you can email me, john@wordballoon.com. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2009.